has this conversation with the religious leaders in which he accuses them of being children of the devil, which is it's a pretty stark thing, stark thing to do. And they go back and forth, and they have this big argument. And finally, he says, they say to him, you're not yet 50 years old, and how is it that you have seen Abraham? Because he was talking about how Abraham had would have rejoiced to see this day and all this, and they ask him this question, and Jesus answers them in verse 58 of chapter 8. Jesus said to them, very truly I tell you, before Abraham was, I am. And again, that's the evoking of the divine name, right? And this is a very powerful thing to do. And it's a very dangerous thing to do, because as soon as they hear that, they pick up, you know, they start looking around for stones to stone him, to put him to death for blasphemy. And he hid himself, and then he left the temple. Okay, so Jesus is in some pretty hot water there at this point, and he's about to be stoned. And as he and then we picked right up at chapter 9. As he walked along, now if I'm thinking, he probably ought not to be walking at this point. He ought to be running very quickly if there is a group of people who are ready to stone him, right? And yet, that's not what happens. It picks up a new story. He was walking along, and he sees a man blind from birth, right? And the disciples ask the question, which is, I think, a question that sometimes we ask too. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? Because obviously somebody sinned, because look what happened. This horrible thing has happened. Somebody had to sin. Somebody's got to be responsible for it, right? And I wonder if that's a response that we still have. Anybody have that sense that you look at somebody and you say, wow, something bad must have happened here. Somebody must be responsible for that.
Well, even did a mother do something while she was carrying that child that she shouldn't have?
Yeah. There you go. That's a good example.
Responsible.
Yeah. A baby is born with some kind of defect, and you say, oh gosh, what did the mom do? Huh? You know, if not sin, you know, what did she do to do this? Right? Yeah, I think that happens still.
I think more frequently the question is asked in regards to God, especially in times of tragedy or illness, injury, things like that. Why is God punishing me? I mean, it's the same question.
Right.
Said in a different way.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Why is this happening to me? Right. And of course, tomorrow we're going to look at Job, and we're going to look at that whole issue much more in depth. But it's here. It's here also. Right. The great thing about this story, though, is Jesus just blows that whole thing away. And he says, no, nobody sinned. This happened for a different reason, that the glory of God would be revealed. You know, that's just wipes it right away. We're not talking about who sinned. We're not talking about who's at fault. We're talking about the revelation of God. The revealing of the glory of God. Right. So maybe we need to get the story out here. It's Jesus then goes on to talk about, you know, we must work while it is day, because night's coming when no one can work. And as long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. Right. Okay. The light of the world is going to then give light and sight to this person. And he goes and he says, he goes and he spits on the ground. This is great. Any doctors here? Yeah. This is great, great medicine. He spits on the ground, makes some mud out of the saliva, puts it on the guy's eyes, and says, go and wash in the pool of Siloam. right? He goes, he washes in the pool, he comes back and he can see. Jesus is gone. And then everybody goes, wait a minute, isn't this the guy that was born blind that begs all the time? And they say, nah, but it looks like him though, doesn't it? And he says, I am the man. You know, or as they might have said in Durham, North Carolina, I'm the man. And they kept asking, how are your eyes open? And he says, well, Jesus put some mud on my eyes, and then I went and washed, and now I can see. You know, it's great because he probably didn't see Jesus spit, so that's probably just put mud on there. That's all he knew, which is probably awfully good. And then they ask, where is he? And he says, I do not know. He's kind of vanished off the scene. So some other things can happen, see?
He didn't know who it was either, did he?
Yeah, no, he doesn't say Jesus. He says, the man. No, he does. The man called Jesus made mud. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and he doesn't know who Jesus is. The man called Jesus is, you know, the man called John, the man called Joe, whatever. You know, there's this guy named Jesus, and he put mud on my eye. So, yeah, I don't think he knows what we know about Jesus, having read up to now, but he knows his name.
And just a little detail, the blind man did not approach Jesus.
There's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Looking back there.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like he even is aware that Jesus is here, present.
Right.
Until Jesus approaches him.
Right. It's as if Jesus has this incredible compulsion to heal someone at this point, because this whole business of we must do the work in the day, you know, light, and I am the light of the world, and so he doesn't even ask the guy if he wants. In other places he asks if the guy wants to be healed. Here he doesn't even ask. He just spits on the ground, makes the mud, boom. All right, here I am. Right. Which also is a great. You always have to balance those stories, the healing stories, about healing and faith. This is a story where the guy doesn't express anything, any faith, any. He doesn't ask nothing. Jesus just heals. So there are places where someone asks to be healed, and Jesus heals them. There are places where Jesus asks other people if they want to be healed. There are places where people are healed and then Jesus says, your faith has made you well. Here, none of that. So all of those things, Jesus heals in all of those different ways. So don't let people lock you into this business of, you know, you have to have faith. And it says right in the Bible, you have to have faith. Well, this guy doesn't have anything. Doesn't express any kind of faith until the very end of the story. But he's already healed by then, you can already see. In one sense. And then at the end, we see that he can see in more than one sense. Did you want to say something? Oh, I thought you raised your hand. Okay, so the story goes on. And they bring him to the Pharisees, you know. They present him before the religious authorities and say, look at this. This is an incredible thing, huh? And, of course, it was on this. Jesus, I don't know why Jesus wants to do this all the time, but Jesus always heals on the Sabbath. I mean, you'd think the guy would learn, you know. Wait a day and then do it.
He's a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego all in one, standing out from the crowd.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. I'm just going to do what I'm going to do, and then you have to do what you're going to do, right? Yeah. But it always strikes.
Maybe he did heal on other days of the week too, but it was important
to record the Sabbath
for us that it be recorded the times when he came down.
Clearly, yes, clearly. But it's so funny because the Gospels are always talking about how he heals on the Sabbath, you know, and they go out of their way to tell us that often, you know, because there is that contrasting. It's going to set up conflict, which is what we're moving towards.
But perhaps it's really intentional that he heals on the Sabbath, and it's intentional that they write it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that it is so evident makes you think that there's a reason, and maybe it has to do with Jesus implicitly teaching that the Sabbath was being kept wrong, and that not working maybe had nothing to do with keeping the day holy.
Mm-hmm.
Or that it should be a day for healing.
Or that it should be a day for healing. Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he said that, right? Isn't it not appropriate that this woman be healed on the Sabbath day?
Yep. Mm. Right. After all, what is the Sabbath for? I mean, it's for healing and restoration, isn't it?
Mm.
Right? I mean, the business of resting, giving the land rest in the Sabbath year is for the regeneration and the healing of the land. And our Sabbath is and rest is for our own healing and for our own resting. And that's, yeah, I think that's true. It serves in the story always to crank up the conflict meter a notch. And that's kind of what I was commenting on. But it absolutely, it's an expression of what the Sabbath day really is about. Yeah. So they begin to ask this guy, all right, how did he do it? And he put mud in my eyes, I washed, and now I see. And some of the Pharisees say, well, obviously this guy's not from God. Healing on the Sabbath can't be from God because he doesn't obey the Sabbath. Others say, well, wait a minute now. How can anybody who's not from God do this thing? Right? And they're divided. So you got the Pharisees and they're arguing with each other about it. The other great place where that happens is in Acts when Paul's in front of them and he sees, you know, the Pharisees who believe in the resurrection and the Sadducees who don't believe in the resurrection, and Paul yells out, "My brother Pharisees, I'm on trial for my belief in the resurrection." And then the Pharisees go, "Hey, yeah, we believe that, yeah." And then they start arguing, and the Sadducees say, no, you can't believe that. And then they go on and on and on, and Paul kind of gets out of it, you know. But here again, the house is divided. And so they don't know exactly what to do. So what they do is they ask the guy, well, what do you think? He opened your eyes after all, and he says, I think he's a prophet. So they didn't believe that he'd been blind, so they have to go get proof. And now here comes the reluctant parents, right? The parents come in. The Pharisees ask him, is this your son? Yes, my son. Was he born blind? Yes, he was born blind. Beyond that, I don't know nothing. Ask him, he's of age, because we don't know. Which is fascinating. But John tells us why. Because it had already been decided that anyone who proclaimed Jesus would be put out of the synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so the parents, they don't want to have anything to do with this because it's controversial. You know? So they're just saying, ask him. Keeping their hands off of it. Because they want to stay in the synagogue after all. You know, who can blame them for wanting to stay in their own place of worship? Well, so they were, his parents, as they say, and it says in 22, his parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. Right?
Isn't that verse an expression of John's anti-Semitism?
Well, I wouldn't say anti-Semitism. I would argue that if when Jesus is talking about, or when John, the Gospels talk about the Jews, they are talking about, he is talking about the religious leaders.
Why doesn't he say so?
Why doesn't he say so?
Yes, he consistently uses the term the Jews when, if you read in the context, okay, he's talking about the religious leaders. And not about every Jew who's ever lived.
Right.
But, you know, an awful lot of Christians over 2,000 years have taken it to mean all the Jews in the world.
Exactly.
It was very careless of him.
I think you're right. I think that there is a sense in which we have taken that and wrongly taken it to mean all Jews. Forgetting, I think John isn't being careless. I think John just can't even fathom that we're going to read this and forget that Jesus is a Jew, forget that all of his disciples are Jews, and forget that the whole early church is Jewish. I think that that's probably more of what of an argument for reading it as those Jews who were in conflict with Jesus. Otherwise, this includes Jesus. The anti-Semitism includes Jesus and includes all of his disciples. And we Christians have never been able to, I mean, I don't know how we did that, but we did it. We were able to convince ourselves that Jesus was a Christian, not a Jew.
But John helped, I think.
I think that...
I mean, by the time he wrote 100, 110, there was a vicious conflict going on, a very competitive conflict going on between Jews and Christians, and the Christians were in the minority, and here was this big Judaism, very dominant religion that was picking on the poor Christians, and maybe a little of that anger and hostility came out.
Right, yeah, you may be right. I think that it was... it's easier to read John's Gospel and say, and look at it with anti-Semitic eyes and get really a lot of ammunition. That much of, you're right. You can get a lot of it. But I don't think that was the intent, but I think that's what we've done. But that's why I think the corrective is, he's not talking about the Jews as a people. I think he's talking about the people who conflict with Jesus, who are the people in leadership, the people he's threatening.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that one of the most important dimensions of what you're saying is that we never read this without noting, without pointing to the fact that it has been read in anti-Semitic ways and that it has contributed to murder of Jews, and that in reading it we simply have to translate, because everything is culturally informed, and if the meaning here really is the Jewish religious elite, just like there's a religious elite all the time, then whenever we read the Gospel of John, that it's terribly important to point that out.
But the little sheet that is put in the bulletins in ELCA churches with the lessons on them does not do that. Uh-huh. And my wife wrote to the editor and said, why don't you put a little explanatory note, and got back a bunch of baloney. Oh. Can't do that.
Oh, well, what you did and what your wife did, to me that seems just to be top notch. And that the more that Christians, informed Christians, point to that, the more that we can disarm this as anti-Semitic literature. I mean, I just commend what your wife did. Mm-hmm. Because people who have no grounding simply don't know that this doesn't mean Jews in general. That's what I think is important in your point. I think it's a really important point.
But I'm just saying, I don't think it consistently is immediately interpreted. I mean, John does this all the time. And I don't think it's always spontaneously interpreted. Well, be sure you realize what he's talking about is religious beliefs.
You're right. It isn't always interpreted that way. And it's gotten us into horrible dilemmas and has brought us to conclusions that are just plain wrong about how Christians treat Jews, or how Christians should see Jews. And I guess I'm just advocating for, let's look at this a different way. That's all. And I think it sounded like you're kind of hoping that look at it in a different way too.
I think we've got to start saying there are roots of this terrible black monarch on the Christian church, which still continues. There are roots in the New Testament. We better identify them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's helpful. Yeah. And I was said in another session that we Christians just don't do very well when we're in the majority and in the power. And in power. We haven't done well. And especially towards the Jews.
Who does do well in power?
You know, that's another great question. Yeah. I'm not sure who does well, but I guess I just take a confessional stand and say, certainly we don't. So, and maybe we could do better, but I don't know. Well, are we okay to move on with this? Because it's an important issue. Because it's all through John. The Jews. So,
before we do, Paul, just to go back, because we scooted right by it. Oftentimes in John, it's the people who are encountering Jesus that identify who he is. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting, looking at this now, where the blind man said that Jesus, he is a prophet. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that Jesus said a whole lot to him. He only experienced the healing.
Right.
And for this man to draw a conclusion that he's a prophet from a healing, I don't normally associate healing with those prophets.
Right.
There's a different role and function for prophets, but it's not really healing. But he's drawn the conclusion that he's a prophet from the healing he's experienced, mm-hmm. which I find a new dimension for prophecy.
Huh. Yeah. It seems to me that, to push on that a little bit, that the prophetic words are for the healing of the nations. But that's sort of a stretch from receiving sight.
You see, that's why I think Jesus' healings, his physical healings, are such a challenge to the religious leaders as well. Because they are a sign of his prophetic nature. Mm-hmm. They are a threat. His healings aren't just for the sake of healing. His healings are a threat to the establishment.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And this blind man has made that connection. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to also make an argument that the healing that happens to this blind man isn't just his eyes, it's also his mouth. That his tongue is unloosed, and we're going to see that shortly, and see what you think about that. So they talk to the parents, they interview the parents, they don't get anywhere with the parents except to know that this indeed was someone who was born blind. And so they call back the man. And they say, give glory to God. We know that this man, I lost my place here. We know that this man is a sinner. He answered, I don't know. I don't know whether he's a sinner or not. All I know is I was blind, now I see. And we should all start singing, right? Amazing grace. And so they go back, they go through it again. How did he do it? And he says, you know, I've told you already, and you wouldn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? This is my favorite part. Do you also want to become his disciples? Then they reviled him, saying, you are his disciple, we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. The man answered, this is really an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but that God listens to those who worship him, right? And obey his will. And ever since the beginning of the world, it's a bit of hyperbole, right? Ever since the beginning of the world has anyone heard of anyone opening the eyes of a person born blind. If this man was not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, "You were born entirely in sin, and you are trying to teach us?" And they drug him out. And drug him out, I think, drug him out of the synagogue. Cast him out, right? Well, now, here's what I think this that whole business is about. Here's a guy who was blind and was totally dependent. I mean, he was a beggar, right? And he had nothing to say about any of the religious establishment. He was just out there begging. His eyes are opened, and all of a sudden, now he's challenging the Pharisees. And they're astonished. You are trying to teach us something? Right. And there he is. He's standing up for himself. And this whole business of healing as a restoration and healing as empowerment allows this guy to stand up in front of people who he would never, ever be able to stand up in front of and to say, look, this is a no-brainer. He opened my eyes. He's got to be from God. And they resent it completely. Because this guy's not supposed to be talking to them like that. But he does. And I think that's part of what the healing is about. So you heal his eyes and you loose his lips.
In what you just said, the power to speak mm-hmm. and the power to witness to the truth, mm-hmm. it strikes me that this must have been, if that's part of the implication of the story, and I hadn't thought about it that way ever before, mm-hmm. this must have been a really powerful story in the day in which it was written. I mean, in a day in which the Christians were suffering persecution, mm-hmm. in the day in which they were being driven out,
yep.
that if the purpose of John's writing was in part to give courage, to tell the people that though they are being driven out, they are with God, they are healed by, they are touched by, God is present with them, mm-hmm. then I can hardly imagine a more powerful way of saying that. And it strikes me that this was probably what you intended in a sense, but it does have power to us today. You know, that there's so much for us to speak out about, to have our lips loosed. Mm-hmm. And though we may be driven out from, you know, whatever we love in our social circles for speaking out against the way the world operates right now, mm-hmm. that God is our companion in that.
Yeah, I think you said in one of your sessions, once you've seen, you can't not see yeah. again, or something. I paraphrased it, whatever. But I think that's the dynamic of this, you know. His eyes are opened. His eyes are opened not only so that he can see. I think there's a more profound sense of healing in this. And I want to maybe go back to that a little bit, because when Jesus says, "I am the light of the world," there were in a time years ago, several years ago, when they first were able to do certain operations on people who were blind, right? Who lived their whole life blind. They were able to do operations on their eyes to make their eyes function in order to see. Okay, and this is early on. Like I think I don't remember exactly the dates, but the they did that for many people, and people were technically healed. Their eyes operated the way their eyes were supposed to operate, but they couldn't see. They couldn't incorporate what was going on through their eyes, and many of them returned to the life that they lived before. Mm-hmm. Before their eyes were healed, restored to functioning. They could, there was some other inner light that they didn't turn on, right? Or they just couldn't practice, or there wasn't enough whatever. But they could, their eyes worked, but they couldn't see. And that has always stuck with me as a profound image, that Jesus as the light of the world opens the eyes of this guy, and the guy can see. It's like this inner light gets turned on as well. You know, the light is able to come in from the outside, but there's that inner light that then can receive that and see. And both literally see, but also then can see the truth around him. And I think for many of us, you know, and that's what Jesus talks about, is going to talk about later, that we see, but we aren't, our eyes function, but we aren't really seeing what's going on. You know, what's the reality there? Or where is Jesus? Or who is Jesus? And that's something that, you know, we strain to see a lot of times. And this story is a story of Jesus giving light and the guy being able to really see everything.
I think what comes to ears is easier because we have two different words there. People can listen, but they may not be hearing.
Yeah.
We don't have those same two verbs to associate with the eye. We're seeing the scene.
Or seeing, maybe seeing and perceiving.
Okay, that might
work. Yeah. But yeah, but that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Do you suppose, I mean, here he sits and begs, do you suppose that he has been hearing, you know, he's been hearing maybe all a lot of this, and then when he gets his eyes open, then all this kind of, all what he's been hearing comes together, and he realizes, hey, all this stuff I've been hearing, this is it.
Yeah.
You know, where he gets the...
Yeah.
Well, a lot of times also going with that is that many times that we see someone who's disabled, we discount them completely. Mm-hmm. This guy wasn't brainless. He was sitting there begging. Mm-hmm. But he had abilities that people probably would not recognize. Very likely not recognize.
Right. And in his station, could not really exercise them.
Exactly.
Right? Which is why the healing is so powerful, because it then unleashes all this stuff.
You bet.
You know? Mm-hmm. It unleashes this great preaching. You know? What do you mean? What do you mean you're confused about this? Let me clarify it for you. He opened my eyes. He's from God. You know, very simplistic. Very simple and very profound. But because of his station or his former station, they say, no.
You're nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. And because of their notion that he was born in sin. Remember, that catches up with the disciples' question at the beginning of the text. You who were born entirely in sin are going to tell us that? Because you were born blind and therefore in sin?
It's interesting when sin is used quite a bit in this passage. Jesus says that I'm not... He wasn't a sinner, his parents weren't sinners.
Right.
I'm doing this... kind of ties into being a prophet. I'm doing this to show a sign.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then later on they say, well, this happened on Sabbath, so he's not of God. And they say, well, how can a sinner do such work? So that
right.
Jesus is called a sinner.
Right.
You have the Pharisees getting really upset and saying, you know, the last resort in an argument saying, you're a sinner, you discredit the
That's right.
speakers. And,
yeah.
But it's interesting, so there's something that the author is saying about what it means to be a sinner or not a sinner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, also, we are all sinners, so I mean, that also is saying something about sinners, and yet we're not sinners, or there's something about how do you separate we as sinners and in these kinds of miraculous works.
Yeah, and okay, yes, I think you're absolutely right, and I think maybe if we don't take sinner as my guess is that we tend to take sinner as someone who commits a sin, you know, slips up, and we commit sins, and so we are sinners. I'm not sure that that's the use of sinner in this piece, that it's more of, it's outside of the circle.
Right. The separation from God, that's
Yeah.
So we have here, if you're in connection with God or Christ, and it's healed. The healing is unmissed. The separation from God is like a kind of sickness or some kind of a unwholeness, and then when you're with God, there's a healing that takes place, and then here's a healing. Mm-hmm. So that's it overcomes sin. I mean, we talk about, you know, the resurrection, that's overcoming sin, but even this kind of a healing is a symbol of
a
wholeness.
I think it's both, as Marcus Borgen and Chad Myers have both taught too, sin also meant that the uncleanliness, that the Pharisee code of life meant that some were holy and clean and others were unclean and unholy, and that the sinner wasn't necessarily, as you said, Paul, someone who committed sins, but someone who could not maintain the cleanliness standards of the day, the holiness standards of the day, and that poor people couldn't and were sinners in that extent. And so separated from God, but in that world, more separated from the capacity to keep the laws that meant you were okay with God, the cleanliness codes. I know Marcus Bork has a whole chapter on that in that book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. It's pretty fascinating. And Woody, the way you said that, this whole story really is sandwiched in between. The first and the last pieces are the sinner thing. They ask if he's a sinner, and Jesus says no, and then the way it ends is the Pharisees say he's a sinner. So it does make that sandwiching in between the claims of being a sinner and Jesus saying he's not a sinner really are key to the passage. And maybe, you know, in a sense, healing on the Sabbath too is saying the cleanliness codes, the holiness codes, are not what make you right with God. Which is also what Jesus saying he's not a sinner has to do with also, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think that's all right. Keeping in mind that this business of the physical location and of you can almost think of it physically. There's the Holy of Holies, right? And then there are the outer corridors of the temple, and going out from that. And the further away you are from the Holy of Holies, the less close you are to God. And so, there's for each ring, you know, that you go out, and the sinner is one who's outside of the whole holiness circle. All right, and those are the folk that Jesus goes to most often. Right, and so this guy is outside of that, and so he's a sinner. They think Jesus is outside of this, so he's a sinner. Jesus is going to redefine all of that, and he's going to turn all of it upside down. But that's the dynamic. Yeah. So they call him a sinner. And they cast him out, they drive him out of the synagogue. And Jesus heard that he was driven out, and he went and found him and said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered, "And who is he, sir or Lord? Tell me that I may believe in him." Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and the one speaking with you is he." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. Jesus said, "I came into the world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see, and those who do see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard this and said to him, "Surely we are not blind, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would not have sinned. But now that you say we see, your sin remains." just turns it all upside down. What do you make of that?
Well, as he's saying to the Pharisees, you just don't see the truth.
I'm sorry?
You just don't see the truth.
Yeah, you definitely don't see the truth. He may be saying, if you didn't see the truth and acted the way you act, I could understand it. But now that you say you see the truth, then you're accountable. And therefore, the way you're acting, your sin remains. Right? I think that's kind of what he's getting at. You know? Once you see the truth and then act differently from it, that's what sin really is. Not living outside of some purity code, but seeing the truth and then acting as if you didn't see it.
That's an indictment on us all.
Yeah, boy, that does kind of tighten in on us, doesn't it?
Ooh. Yeah. To see something and not step forward to correct it or address it.
The thing about this story is, you know, you're grooving with the guy. You're grooving with the blind guy, right? You know, because, yeah, you know, Jesus is really doing it, right? This blind guy's getting in there and he's feisty and you're really, yeah, man, you're fighting for us, right? And then at the end of the story, whoosh, you get this turnaround and you realize, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. Hey, I'm standing with the Pharisees. What am I doing with these guys? I don't want to be with these guys. And the story sort of hooks us. And what do we say? Yes. Oh.
It's also. Oh.
I'm sorry. Your hand was waving, but I didn't know if you were pointing at something or. No. Okay.
There's also kind of interesting dynamics where at the start of the story. The disciples are bringing up a question, something that they've heard in the air, you know, like that, you know, is he born in sin, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all indirect, you know, kind of allusions, and Jesus could just answer that and be on his way, but he really pushes the question in a way that he ends up talking to the source of, you know, these questions, of these problems, and he gets them to ask, you know, surely we are not blind, are we? I mean, all these steps so that it leads up to the source is asking the question of him.
Right.
And then he's right there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just interesting. And whether the healing on the Sabbath has a role in that or whatever, but it's taking from the indirect, like, this might be a problem, but you wouldn't really have to, you know, we're curious.
Right.
To the point of conflict, where they ask him directly.
Right. And there's a lot more at stake in the second asking, right? I mean, the first one, the disciples are sort of removed from it, and they, and you know, who, just out of curiosity, like you said, out of curiosity, who sinned here is, you know, this is kind of a theological question we've been wondering about Jesus. Who sinned here is parents. Can you tell us? And there, that's, like you said, that's indirect, that's removed. And then at the end, it's a very direct question. You know, we aren't blind, are we? And there it is. Yeah.
To me, it's so interesting how Christ is at the beginning and the end of the story. At the beginning, of the part where he touches the man and heals him when he didn't even ask for it. That's just so beautiful.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, there's all the squabbling and bickering back and forth. And at the end, here comes Christ again with the exclamation point. You know, this is it.
Yeah, yeah, and we do skip over that. I did anyway. This business of the bringing together of the man and Jesus. It's really the first time that they talk, right? After he's been thrown out of the synagogue, Jesus is there to catch him. Right?
But goes and finds it.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got to ask around, where did that guy go?
Yeah, exactly. He finds him, he seeks him out, and there he is. And then he says, asks him to confess, do you believe in the Son of Man? He says, well, who is it? It's me.
Why didn't the Pharisees stone Jesus as soon as they saw him again? Or were they different guys?
You know, yeah, that's... The flow of the story doesn't, in some ways, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, if the Pharisees are standing by him, they were going to stone him for blasphemy, and now they're back to verbal banter with Jesus.
Maybe they left.
Yeah, I don't have any.
Ones came.
Huh?
Maybe it's different ones.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know.
And it's a collage, I think.
Yeah, a collage. That's a great word. Yeah, it's a collage of stories. And this one, you know, it's an interesting question because they're just ready to stone him. And then this whole story happens. And I think they should be ready to stone him after this story too. But
it ends.
And it ends. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe it works.
You know that last verse. Excuse me, you go you first.
But in this story at least, they're divided.
Yeah.
And just looking ahead in chapter 10, verse 19, again the Jews were divided because of these words.
Yeah.
It seems to me that when they were ready to stone him, they were all in agreement. I mean, it was very clear.
Yeah.
But there's enough confusion amongst them around this particular issue, and it obviously has moved on,
mm-hmm.
that until they feel in concert with each other about the conviction, they're not going to stone him.
Huh.
Can I ask a question? What are we talking about? How many Pharisees are we talking about, actually? In all, you know, how many?
For me,
how many would be at one place at one time in one synagogue?
There'd be a good bunch of them in Jerusalem at the temple. How many people are in
30?
Well, how many people are in the Sanhedrin?
70.
And so there's a group of 70 that are not all Pharisees. There's Pharisees and there's different sects of priests, but that 70 is the kind of the ruling body, okay? And then there would be folks who are not a part of that ruling body too. Around and in Jerusalem, centered in Jerusalem, so a fair amount. Yeah.
Yes. I want to go back to verse 41 there when Jesus says, if you were blind, you wouldn't be guilty of sin, but now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains.
Uh-huh.
It talks to me about people who say, I know the truth. I'm sure this is the way it is. This is the way. This is what you must do. This is what you must believe.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who are blind.
Or at least accountable.
In Jesus' terms here, he says, those are the ones that if you claim you can see, if you claim you've got it, you're the ones who are blind.
I'm interested in this passage too, and I've been thinking about it as it's a real destabilizing thing, as Paul pointed out, and the question is, what is it trying to say about our relationship to our faith or our understanding or our knowledge of God or what is, for me, it's challenging the relationship of ourselves to our concept of God. It sort of fits in with the mystical feeling of this gospel in that God is ineffable. We can never know what we think we know.
Yeah.
But I've been wondering if the blind person is someone who can truly see, or the formerly blind person, who is also poor and disenfranchised, and those who are enfranchised and visually unimpaired or privileged are unable to see. I mean, it's a political statement too, in other words.
Yeah, but there's so many levels on that, aren't there?
Yeah, but I guess I'm interested in the faith and reason aspect of this. If you think that you're one of the experts and rationalize your way to God and know the law and all that stuff, what is this saying about those who have true faith versus those who are the experts. And
what is true
wondering
faith?
What you have to say about that.
Yeah. What is, and then what is true faith?
Yeah.
I'm thinking about this too. The blind man has an encounter with Jesus. We all have an encounter with Jesus. I mean, the Pharisees are encountering Jesus all the time. So there's something. Jesus isn't just passive. He engages people as he goes along. And how do you respond to that encounter? And something happens to this person. I mean, he certainly goes from blind to being having sight, but also Jesus asks him, "Well, what do you think?" You know, and he said, "You know, I'm the Messiah," and the blind man believes and says and worships. Now the Pharisees, they encountered Jesus and nothing happened. I mean, they didn't sense any difference. We don't know who you are. I mean, who am I? Well, I don't know who you are. You heal, you do this, but we don't know who you are. So there's no change in them. And Jesus is talking about some kind of a change. Surely we are not blind, are we? Well, your own words kind of point out that if you don't know it, if you don't see me, then you must be blind. If you don't perceive what's going on, then you are blind. I mean, it's not me telling you you're blind, it's you saying that you don't see anything. So
he's there to turn the tables somehow of the way people had been perceiving all along, to have them look and see in a new way.
But I think what's interesting is this passage is saying, if you can't see it, your sin remains. If you don't see it, your sin remains.
Is that what it says?
But if you do see it, your sin remains too.
If you say you see, your sin
remains. No, he's saying, they say that we see. It's not what you say, it's what you perceive. They're saying,
I see.
We're not blind, are we? And he says, well, look, if you don't see that I am the Messiah and worship me, if you're not responding to the encounter, mm-hmm. you're not really seeing, even though you think you're seeing, they don't know whether they're seeing or not. They're saying, are we blind? Or it seems to me that they're just, and he's saying, well, because you're not perceiving, you're seeing but not perceiving, your sin remains. You know,
That's another way of all right, I understand what you're saying. I think.
But then there's the right and wrong perception, and who's to say who has which?
Yeah.
Well, what I'm saying is it's a response. The blind man is responding by worshiping Jesus. The Pharisees are responding by saying, we're not blind, are we? Or how can a person heal on the Sabbath? I mean, they're locked into a certain place, and they can't see what's going on.
They can't move to the place of confession
right.
of Jesus. Is
right.
that
right?
Right? And which is true seeing.
Yeah.
That would really fit with, again, back in this context. It's being written to empower and encourage people who are confessing Jesus to do so. And I suppose it's very powerful to do that by pointing to the blindness of the Pharisees, of the religious elite who are throwing out John's community out of the synagogue. So it does make sense that seeing has to do in that context with confessing Jesus.
Right.
And that blindness has to do with not confessing Jesus.
I think so. Mary, are we getting at what you're...
I don't think it's resolvable. I just think it's interesting how it's tucked in there. So concisely at the end, and as you say, it's the provocative statement, but I think it's really a question of faith versus reason and challenging us.
The story that I told you yesterday afternoon, I'm going to tell it again. I hope you don't mind. In my former congregation, there was I was just out of seminary, so I was a really good Pharisee. Right. I mean, well trained in the best schools, you know, studied under Gamaliel. No, that was the other part. And so I knew what was going on. You know, I knew what I was doing. And I went to this church, and I was supposed to be the preacher and the prayer and, you know, all these things, right? And, I didn't know how to pray at all. I mean, I didn't know anything about prayer. And, the way it happened was, these older women in my church would come by and say, Pastor, come on now, we got to go to Miss Frances' house because we're going to pray. She's sick, we got to pray. And so I'd say, okay. And, you know, thinking, okay, I'm in charge here, I'm gonna pray. And I'd go and do this little feeble thing, right? And then the women would pray. And then they'd really pray. I mean, they were praying. And what I did was nothing. I mean, what I did was Pharisaic. And, you know, I got out my occasional services book and read my little thing. But they prayed. Because they prayed to Jesus. Because they knew Jesus. Right? And to me, that was how I learned how to pray, was by going to the house of people who were sick with these people who knew how to pray. And, you know, if you were going to talk about faith and reason, well, I had all the reason in the world, right? I mean, I had good training and all that stuff. And these folks, some of them never finished high school. But who knew how to pray? Who could see and who couldn't see? And I think that happens all the time. You know, and we who think we've got it have got to, well, I think we just, I don't think we can even, you know, the popular thing is we've got to go be among the poor and all of that. And you know, maybe. But even then, we can go and be among the poor and not see it. I think it's, I think God kind of says, hey, you, come here, boom, and put you there, and then, oh, okay, yeah, you can see it, you know, and it's this great gift that happens, and it's a mystery. That's how I see that, Mary.
I think the critical thing in that last verse, which is surely the capstone of the whole passage, is if you say you see, you're guilty. I mean, that's a formula for the constant renewal of the Christian and of the church. Whenever you think you've got it, you are in trouble.
God pulls it out from under you, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Constant renewal.
Yeah.
When you just said that, it made me think of your earlier comment about the anti-Semitism. And part of our constant renewal is re-seeing what the text says about Jews and doesn't say about Jews. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, it's sort of off the direct subject, but I wanted to come back to that for a minute because I remembered something that my New Testament professor taught me. Mm-hmm. And she refused to let anyone read John without displacing the word Jews and using the religious elite. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing we can do in reading the text.
Doesn't the American Bible Society or whoever put that people?
Because they make so many translation errors. But the other thing,
people been complaining about this for how long?
Well, they make a lot of errors in the translation.
But this is NRSV.
But they make errors too. I mean, they make errors.
But they're translating the Greek.
Right, but I just wanted to say one other thing we could do. Okay. I think we could go and find Jewish commentators on this and see what they say. Because I think your point is extremely important. If we don't undo, when we read John, if we don't undo the anti-Semitism, we're perpetuating it. And it just struck me that one thing we could do is get Jewish commentators and see what they say. There's a Jewish translation of the New Testament by the Hebrew Bible Society or the Hebrew Society in Israel, and see what they say about that word. Mm-hmm. That might be one way.
Ask Amy Jo Levine.
Oh, sure.
Not New Testament scholar. Orthodox Jew.
Have you read this passage in Greek? I have not read it in Greek. I don't know what the Greek does.
Yeah.
I just thought when you said ever that to see anew, and I thought the church ever reforming, and it just struck me that that's one of the reformations we need to be.
One of the other references to Jews in the other Gospels, in Luke, I think it is, where Luke uses the leaders of the temple in almost in the same context.
And if that was the meaning, I don't understand why it's not in every body. If that was the meaning, the leaders of the Jews.